It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It may be the most significant decision of Barack Obama's presidency, an announcement of a big change in U.S.-Cuba relations, kicking down the last wall of the Cold War, a move to normalize relations and trade policy after over half a century of broken ties.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
So what opportunities might this move create for the city of Pittsburgh? I'm joined now in Studio A by Carnegie Mellon University Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies, Kenya Dworkin-Emendez. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me. I'm very appreciative.
Also with us is University of Pittsburgh Associate Professor of Political Science, Scott Morgenstern, joining us by phone. Scott Morgenstern, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And there are mixed reactions here in the United States to normalizing relations with Cuba. How do you feel about it? You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh, hashtag EPLive. Kenya Dworkin-Emendez, as someone who was born in Cuba and is of Cuban descent, what does the restoration of ties between the United States and Cuba mean to you?
Well, I think it's a monumental announcement. It's a monumental move forward after having had over 50 years of no change in the situation between the two countries. But I don't even want to say I'm, you know, guardedly optimistic. I don't think it's a panacea. There's just so much to this situation on both sides, but particularly in Cuba, that we're not talking about, and that will take a long time to see in terms of how it pans out.
And we'll get into some of those thorny issues. But I want to ask either of you, did you see this coming?
Well, I personally thought that there was something going on behind closed doors, but I didn't have any specific details about it. But I think that there have been some gestures made by President Obama at several international meetings where Raul Castro was as well, and it seemed as there was some rapprochement, you know, between the two of them. But I certainly didn't have details about what was going on with Pope Francis and Canada facilitating meetings.
Scott Morgenstern, what about you?
Yeah, our center, the Center for Latin American Studies here at Pitt, ran a big conference on Cuba and reform process in a comparative perspective about a month ago. And we had people here from Cuba, long-term Cuba watchers, as well as people from the rest of the world, and nobody had an inkling of this coming. And if we look back at it now, we see a few signs. As Kenya just mentioned, that there was a couple of meetings that the Cuba is going to be involved with, and the U.S. just recently said that they weren't going to block their participation, and a few other small signs along the way. But certainly, up to this moment, we didn't expect anything coming.
And what are the potential benefits of this new arrangement?
For whom?
For Cuba and the United States, and then we'll get into Pittsburgh more specifically. But you know, as far as there was some rejoicing in quite a bit of rejoicing in Cuba, as we heard from reports on NPR this morning. Reaction a little more mixed in the United States. Some people saying this is a good thing, but many Cuban refugees in other parts of the United States saying they feel like Obama is a traitor for doing what he's doing. So let's talk about what the incentives are here. Why, there's been a lot of tension between these two countries, over half a century's worth. So what is the good in setting that aside?
Well, on the Cuban side, I can say that there have been signs of change, although not at the level of government. There is a groundswell of civil activism, of civic activism. There are a lot of independent groups that are not legally recognized by the Cuban government that are doing a lot of work on the ground, grassroots type work, to kind of retrain citizens to be active participatory citizens in decision-making processes. There's also a very active civil rights movement in Cuba, and I think that the Cuban government has always repressed these groups, but I think that they have been bothering them less lately. They haven't been including them in official conversations, but they have been allowing events to happen that they organize, and I think that's a sign of change. I think for Cuba, the most important thing here is economic, and you know, I think everyone knows that the Cuban economy is a disaster. And particularly since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 89 and after the special period, which I guess for some is not over. But and no one can blame the embargo of Cuba for the disaster of the Cuban economy. I believe it has had an enormous impact, but you can't blame the entire failure on the embargo. It has to do with the Cuban economy.
But lifting the embargo
is going to definitely help open up economic ties and relations. But my main thing will be to wait and see how that affects people on the ground.
Scott, what do you see as far as the potential benefits of this for both countries?
As Kenya said, there's a lot to be seen, but there's both tangible and intangible benefits, some of which will be very immediate and some that we'll see what happens over a longer period of time. The intangible part is that we sort of remove this enemy off of our shores that's only 90 miles away. They're reevaluating, I guess, that they're Cuba's position on the terrorist watch list, which if that goes away, then you open up commercial relationships in a very different way because financial institutions can then start to work with them. And a lot of the licensing, I believe, has already changed from the president's statement. So third-party countries can now trade much more easily than they had before. The United States, by changing this, facilitates relationships and travel relationships. To give you an example, our center and the study abroad program here at Pitt has a relationship where we send students to Cuba every year. 2 years ago, or a year and a half, we had to cancel the program because the bank that was handling the visa applications was no longer allowed to handle those because they were working with Cuba. So the whole program had to be canceled. That kind of thing is going to go away immediately. So economically and for travel reasons, it's going to open up the relationships quite a bit. The embargo is a big question. That requires congressional action, and so whether that will happen or not, we'll have to wait and see. Because as you said, there's a number of people in Congress who are strongly opposed, but the majority, I think, would vote for an overturn of that.
Well, there are also a number of people in Congress who had no idea this was coming either yesterday and caught a lot of people by surprise. Kenya, what about the opportunities, economic and otherwise, for Pittsburgh? What kinds of opportunities does this create for a city like ours that has reinvented itself, that has this strong Eds and Meds community?
Well,
what happens?
First of all, I mean, we need to know, for example, that even though there is an embargo, there are a number of states in the United States that have already been doing business with Cuba, and Pennsylvania is one of them, selling them agricultural products on a cash basis, and other states also sell agricultural products and medical products. There's also been a long-term interest in Cuba in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is a city, is a progressive city, and there have been a lot, because of the university centers and because of its labor history, I believe there's always been a strong tie between the two places and a lot of interest, mutual interest. I think that one of the greatest things that Pittsburgh at this very moment has to offer Cuban society is the fact that Pittsburgh is considered perhaps the top city in the nation in terms of its civic health, according to the Civic Health Index, and it's become a center for deliberative democracy. I believe that this is something that we can model to the Cuban people and to the Cuban government, how citizens can be engaged in constructive conversations to achieve consensus on how to move forward on certain issues. Thanks to Bob Cavalier and the Center for Deliberative Democracy at CMU, a number of the Cuban activists who have visited us twice in the past 2 years have already benefited from workshops with him and are instituting these workshops in Cuba and are all around Cuba, not just in Havana. As far as economic benefits and cultural benefits. The cultural benefits are definitely there. I've been very active in bringing Cuban culture, you know, hip-hop, poetry, painting, political science, and all kinds of stuff to the city. There's a great deal of interest in it. There's also interest particularly amongst the African-American community because Cuba has a very strong African identity. And economically, I think that the fact that Americans will be able to travel there and spend money there and bring back Cuban products will obviously be an incentive for people to go, not to mention that it's been a forbidden place for a long time. And despite the fact some people have traveled there illegally through third countries, the day they're able to go without getting a Treasury Department license and just are able to go like they go anywhere else is going to be not only economically beneficial, but encourage people-to-people exchange, which is how countries really learn about each other.
Did you mean State Department license or
The Treasury Department license. I mean, because of the Trading with the Enemy Act, Americans have to apply for a Treasury Department license to go to Cuba for very specific reasons, even if they're not going to do business. That's the way the law is set up.
Wow. I'm sure a lot of people weren't aware of that.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back to something you mentioned earlier about people in Cuba, being allowed, being given a little more leeway in terms of assembling.
A little bit.
I'm curious because of the relationship Cuba's had to Russia, or really the old Soviet Union, which is why this whole embargo started in the first place. Fidel Castro had so identified himself with the Soviet model, and to this day, the Russians under Putin, I mean, they have quashed dissent. So which way will Cuba go? Will they take their cue from the United States now, maybe more, or are they still kind of tied to Mother Russia?
Neither. I would have to say neither. There's actually a movement in Cuba, a civil movement, to reform the constitution. The current constitution in Cuba is based on the Soviet model. It's obsolete, and it needs to be reformed. And there is a very valiant group of people who are working to try to work either to change the constitution or to adopt a constitution that was written in 1940 and adapted to the current time. And so, therefore, I think that neither country is really in a position to provide the model. There are people in Cuba, many of the people who are activists, political activists and civil rights activists in Cuba want change to come from within Cuba, and they want it through their system. They want their system to evolve rather than have abrupt change. And I think that's something that people here don't understand.
We are talking about the move to normalize relations between the United States and Cuba here on Essential Pittsburgh with Carnegie Mellon University Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies, Kenya Dworkin-Emendez. Also with us by phone is University of Pittsburgh Associate Professor of Political Science, Scott Morgenstern. We have Daryl on Twitter who says, I applaud the move to normalize relations with Cuba. Its time has come. Scott Morgenstern, what will the impact on the poor be in Cuba? How will this help people in the lower classes? And Kenya, you can chime in on this too.
Well, the big question is what kind of new job opportunities they're going to have. There have been an important number of reforms taking place in Cuba over the last number of years, with some important limitations, great limitations. But there are more private businesses and who they can hire, and with the influx of trade that this will happen, or the influx of tourists in particular, there will be a lot more opportunity for small restaurants, small hotels, and things like this, which will be able to employ people. I think that will be the most direct benefit of the poor overall.
I agree with what Scott has said, but what some people don't realize is that the reforms that there have been, which have been important and have had a positive impact on a number of people in Cuba, have also exacerbated the divide between those who might be the haves and those who are the have-nots. Because when the state, for example, decided it had to reduce the size of its state employment force, they encouraged people to become self-employed. But in Cuba, unless you own your own home, which is possible, but if you didn't own your own home or have a car or have a family elsewhere outside Cuba that was sending you capital, there was very little people could do to be self-employed. And so, therefore, these reforms have exacerbated the economic divide. And so, yes, the influx of tourist dollars and so on is going to be beneficial, but a lot of the people who don't have those other options are working in areas of tourism that I would rather see them not be working in because they're not necessarily good jobs or even nice jobs
as well. That is, as Kenya suggested, many of the people who do have the advantages because they have relatives in the United States who have been sending them money. Those are largely the not the African, Afro-Cuban population, and so the divide, which didn't really exist, or at least was one of the great successes of the revolution, was leveling the playing field, has now become much more evident, and promises to be more so in the future.
What about of course, there are a lot of people who are not happy about this news. What about the Cuban-American relatives who say that this arrangement and the prisoner swap is a slap in the face to relatives of activists murdered by the Castro regime?
I totally understand where that particular part of the Cuban exile community is coming from. This is now no longer one block of people, but rather there are numbers of generations with different mentalities. I totally understand where they're coming from and respect their pain as I respect the pain they felt when they had to leave the country they loved. But I feel that their insistence that we continue to use a policy that in over 50 years has not managed to do what it was supposed to do in the first place is pointless. And so therefore I think that this normalization of relations between the two countries will allow for even more discussions about these kinds of painful issues, whereas now there's no discussion whatsoever.
Are there any lingering painful issues for you? I mean, you were born in Cuba. You left there as an infant, but...
Yes, there are. I mean, I left there as an infant. I've lost most of my family in Cuba now, but I have cousins there who are my age and who have expressed an interest in not meeting me because they have assumed that because I'm from the United States, I have certain political views, which I don't. And I also still find it, and I'm going to say it this way, immoral that I would have to apply for a Treasury Department license to go to Cuba.
So you have not met many of your Cuban relatives?
And
you're saying they do not want to meet you?
No, I know this for a fact. My uncle there died a couple of years ago, but in telephone conversations with him, I broached the subject of meeting my cousins there, and he told me that they expressed emphatically that they were not interested in meeting a Gusano cousin.
Why?
Because they assumed that I was going to be anti-Cuba.
And were they right?
No. So the day that I can travel there in an unfettered manner, I will be able to go and knock on the door and introduce myself and have that conversation without having to worry about what the U.S. government thinks or what money I spend, or what the Cuban government thinks, or if they're going to follow me around because I do work with dissidents there. I mean, that's the future I want.
Can you talk about the precarious situation that those working for change in Cuba are in? You have been involved in helping from the United States to advance the cause of people who are working for change in that island nation. How will this new arrangement impact that work?
That remains to be seen because, as I said, this is an economic opening. Because there's economic reform, that does not mean that there is a guarantee of political or social reform. To date, as I say, the government has allowed certain events to occur, whereas a couple of years ago they would just have arrested the people and locked them away for
right.
a couple of weeks. But, like the issue of racism in Cuba, for example. I mean, Cuba denied for years and years and years that there was racism. And then a few years ago, the president, Raul Castro, had to finally come out publicly and admit that there are problems with racism. And then they decided to open up spaces within their official government spaces and appoint who could officially address the subject. But there are many people in civil society who are doing, grassroots organizations, the people being affected by the racism, who are working to change this and to educate people about this, but they're not allowed in those spaces and they're not given a public voice, which is why I work with a journal that's published in the United States that publishes work by these people, which would never be published in Cuba because it's illegal.
And certainly the City of Asylum here in Pittsburgh.
Absolutely,
has been very
and I've worked with them and they've been very supportive and I'm very grateful to them.
Let's take a phone call from George in Moon. George, welcome to the conversation on Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, the reason I prompted this call was because I've been following the Cuban thing since I was 20 years old. I was in the Air Force as a young airman, in a strategic air command base that supported B-52s. And I saw vividly what took place during the Cuban Missile Crisis with the loading of nuclear weapons onto vast numbers of B-52s and them taking off for an attack on the Soviet Union at the time. But that being said, what I'm calling for is that I completely support Obama's normalization with Cuba. I mean, regardless of the past, the old Cold War is over. The Soviet Union is no longer a factor with Cuba. They supply some arms for defense, but they are not a factor in this. And I think I've long wanted to travel to Cuba and see it, and I will very soon. I was planning this year to go. But I think that this is an old Cold War policy that should be put to bed, and that right now I think this is about economics more than anything else. The Europeans are doing very well, and the Israelis doing very well economically with Cuba as things are now. But I think that normalization, just like normalization with Vietnam, I'm a Vietnam veteran also, would be immensely great for both peoples.
Great, great point, George. And and you know, we're still working on that the normalization of and the change in relations with Vietnam, and this and Cuba will certainly be a work in progress as well. I'd like to ask Scott Morgenstern. You know, President Obama still feels that Cuba needs to clean up its act on the human rights front. How far do you think Raul Castro is willing to go?
First, let me just say that I would agree with most of what the caller said, that the policy really has become sort of an anachronism because it's, it harkens back to the days of the Cold War where we were worried about relations with the Soviet Union. We were worried about exportation of the Cuban Revolution to Latin America and other parts of the world. And then the other piece, as you're suggesting, is human rights. Cuba's human rights policies are not wonderful. They're a whole lot better than what they used to be, and they're probably better than China, with whom we have, you know, very strong diplomatic and economic ties. And putting it in those comparative terms seems to make this policy really not make much sense. I mean, the change is what does make sense, and it's been very difficult for presidents for a long time to make that change. But Obama, it seems, has finally taken the opportunity at a ripe time to do that.
Well, it's been an interesting conversation, and certainly the developments in this historic piece of history, the U.S. and Cuba, after over half a century now moving toward normalizing relations. There are many people who didn't think it would come in their lifetime, but now it's happening, and it's been a pleasure talking with both of you about it. The Carnegie Mellon University Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies, Kenya Dworkin-Emendez. Thank you so much for being with us here in Studio
A.
Thank
you so much for inviting me. I'm happy to talk on the subject.
And also Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Pittsburgh, Scott Morgenstern. Scott, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a conversation with former Pittsburgh police officer Sheldon Williams about the use of deadly force by police in the wake of the killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.